So our passage this morning then is Acts chapter 25. And I guess as passages go, this is not a particularly earth-shattering one. It doesn't blow your mind. It's a straightforward, no-frills piece of narrative. But nevertheless, we shouldn't skip over it. There are noteworthy things in it. There are matters that we can profitably consider together here. And I'm going to highlight then three in particular. And the first thing I want us to notice in this passage is a mystery. A mystery. You may have seen in the news this past week the story of this container ship that has been stranded at sea off Southeast Asia for about 4 weeks. The company that owned the ship filed for bankruptcy while this ship was at sea, and apparently then a ship whose owners have filed for bankruptcy isn't a very attractive proposition for port authorities, and no harbour then was allowing this ship to dock. No one wanted it clogging up their harbour, and so there it sat 40 miles offshore until this situation was resolved. And in the end, the situation was resolved and the crew's ordeal is now over. And some of the crew were from Scotland and so subsequently spoke to the BBC about their experience and how frustrating it was just languishing there out at sea for all that time, going absolutely nowhere. And in Acts chapter 25, Paul then isn't languishing out at sea. That will come later, of course. But in Acts 25, Paul is languishing in custody in Caesarea. But Luke then, I think, wants us to view this situation that Paul is in as perhaps a little bit similar to the situation of those sailors in that container ship. He wants us, I think, to get the impression here that Paul is stranded and he's kind of going nowhere, and it's a rather frustrating situation. He conveys that in at least two ways. So first of all, notice an emphasis on time in our passage. Actually, that emphasis on time, it begins in the last verse of the previous chapter where we read, when 2 years had elapsed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and so on. So even before our chapter begins, 2 years have already elapsed. Paul in custody in Caesarea. But then these time references continue throughout our passage. So verse 1, 3 days after Festus had arrived in the province. Verse 6, he stayed in Jerusalem not more than 8 or 10 days. Again, verse 6, the next day. Verse 13, when some days had passed. Verse 14, they stayed there many days. Verse 23, the next day. And so you see there are all these references to time. And okay, some of those references are to fairly short time periods, just the next day or 3 days later or whatever. But of course, as a reader, you don't kind of carefully add up 1 day here plus 3 days there and arrive at a total for the time that Luke is talking about. Rather, you just get this sense that time is passing and more time is passing and more time is passing. That's the effect that Luke, I think, wants to create here. So there's an emphasis on time. And then secondly, there's a sense of repetition. I mean, particularly in the early verses of the chapter, you really get a sense of deja vu, don't you? Another Roman governor, another Jewish assassination attempt on Paul, another formal trial before a Roman governor, another instance of bias, Festus wanting to do the Jews a favor, verse 9, just as Felix had done the Jews a favor back in verse 27 of the last chapter. We've been through all of this before. And so I'm saying then there are these two important features that Luke has built into his narrative here, an emphasis on time and a sense of repetition. And of course we saw, didn't we, a few weeks ago, we talked about that irresistible current. Remember, we used that language, that irresistible current that is driving Paul onwards toward Rome. You remember the word must in chapter 23, verse 11. Jesus appears to Paul in the night and says, "You must testify also in Rome." And there's this irresistible current of Jesus must, Jesus will, Jesus sovereign determination and resolve. And that motif certainly isn't overridden here in our chapter. It's still there because, of course, the assassination attempt of the Jews, it's foiled yet again. And, of course, we have Paul's appeal to Caesar in verse 12, or verse 11 rather, which brings Paul's arrival in Rome a step closer. So yes, the irresistible current, it's still in operation, but boy, it's a very, very slow current. That's the point I think Luke is making here in chapter 25. Yes, Paul may still be en route for Rome because the sovereign Jesus Christ is determined he is going to testify to him in Rome, but all the same, it's a decidedly protracted and tortuous and tedious and circuitous route to Rome that Paul is taking. It's a route where time is constantly passing and where at points he just seems to be going round in circles and covering all the same ground over again. And this is the thing. Paul may well be using his time in Caesarea to do useful things. I mean, we saw, didn't we, back in chapter 24, verse 23, that by Roman standards, it's a fairly tolerable form of custody that Paul is in, and he's allowed to have visitors and allowed some liberty and all the rest of it. So doubtless Paul is using his time there to do some useful things. He may well be writing. He may well be studying. He may well be giving face-to-face instruction to believers who are coming to visit him from time to time. He may well be evangelizing the officers who are presiding over him. Certainly he will be praying. We can be absolutely sure of that. But I'll tell you what he wasn't doing. He wasn't taking the gospel to any unreached cities in that first century world. He wasn't reasoning with the Jews in any synagogues. He wasn't confronting the great first century strongholds of idol worship and paganism. He wasn't planting new churches. He wasn't visiting recently planted churches to teach them the great truths of the Bible. He wasn't identifying and taking under his wing John Mark's and Timothy's, new leaders, a new generation of leaders for the Christian church. He wasn't doing any of those things. And those, of course, were the things that Paul did best. Those were the things that Paul did better than anyone else in the first century church did them. Those were the things that Paul did so relentlessly and so effectively during those middle chapters of Acts when the church was expanding with such rapidity and such vibrancy. And he's not doing any of those things now. Week after week after week. Month after month after month, year after year in Caesarea, he's not doing any of those things. And it forces the question, why, doesn't it? If Jesus is sufficiently in control of events that he can ensure Paul gets to Rome at all, then he's sufficiently in control of events that he can get into Rome a lot quicker than this. Why? Why is he allowing his key man, his preeminent preacher and teacher, to be so stranded in Caesarea? Why doesn't he quicken the irresistible currents? And okay, we've all read 2 Corinthians. We understand Paul's theology of suffering and trials. We understand that as Christians we are united to a Jesus Christ who won salvation through a cross, who at his weakest was actually at his most effective and fruitful. And we appreciate then that there's this principle at the very heart of Christian experience: when I am weak, then I am strong. We understand all of that, but isn't this taking it a little bit far? I mean, we can see how that principle applies when Paul is facing a stoning in Lystra. or when he's facing a shipwreck in the Mediterranean. We can see how that principle applies to short, sharp trials like those. But this long-term sidelining of Paul, this removal of Paul from the action for a significant chunk of his apostolic career. Why? How can that be beneficial? How can whatever advantages Jesus might weave into our trials, how can those advantages outweigh the disadvantages, the obvious and manifold disadvantages of Paul languishing in Caesarea for all this time? How can the man who turned upside down the Artemis-worshipping, magic-addicted city of Ephesus be best deployed by Jesus in Caesarean custody, facing a protracted cycle of Jewish plots and Roman trials? I mean, no football coach leaves his fully fit, on-form star player languishing, unused amongst the substitutes. Saturday afternoon, after Saturday afternoon, after Saturday afternoon. No prime minister leaves her talented future leadership material colleague languishing, unpromoted on the back benches for her whole term of office. Why is Jesus leaving Paul languishing in Caesarea? Well, the answer is, we don't know the answer. We don't know. The way the sovereign Jesus Christ fulfills his purposes is often, from our perspective, shrouded in mystery, isn't it? His methods and strategies often don't conform to our ideas of what is productive and effective. In fact, quite the opposite. His methods and strategies often leave us bewildered and reeling. So there's an outstandingly gifted preacher, and he's instrumental in the conversion and growth of many people. And he falls into sexual sin, and he never preaches again. Why? There's a godly Christian mother with a large family of young children, and she becomes afflicted with cancer and dies. Why? There's a little evangelical church in a town where it's the only evangelical church. And within a short space of time, its two main families have to leave because of work, and the church is unsustainable. Why? You think at such times, don't you, well, has Jesus got the wrong preacher? Has he got the wrong young mother? Has he got the wrong evangelical church? Did he intend these circumstances for others who were more dispensable? Has he somehow got mixed up? Well, of course he hasn't. Jesus' sovereignty is infallible. He doesn't make mistakes. But there's a lot of mystery, nonetheless. And all I'm doing then in our first point this morning is reminding you that actually it's always been thus. This isn't a new phenomenon. You go back to Paul and it was like this then. I mean, imagine the Christian congregations in Corinth and Thessalonica and Philippi. And they know, don't they, the importance of Paul's ministry. At a human level, they are everything to Paul's ministry. And it's a Wednesday night, and these congregations, they have their prayer meetings. And there they are at the prayer meeting. And when it comes to the time where points have been shared for prayer, they ask, any news of Paul? Has there been an email from Paul this week? And the reply comes back from the elders, there's been another email. He's still in custody in Caesarea, and there's no sign of any progress. And the following Wednesday night, they gather again. Any news of Paul? Yeah, he's still in Caesarea, still in custody, no sign of anything happening. And it goes on week after week after week. And then 1 week, the reply comes from the elders, oh yes, you do need to pray for Paul because there was recently an assassination attempt by the Jews on him. You know, just like the one we prayed about 2 years ago. And then another week, oh yes, you do need to pray for Paul because he's got another trial before a Roman governor. You know, just like the one we prayed for 2 years ago. Across these congregations then, the sheer, unrelenting, cyclical nature of this impasse must at times have done their heads in, mustn't it? And if you felt like that sometimes, because of some situation in your life, or in the local church, or in the wider church, you need to know it's nothing new. It's always been thus in our Lord's running of our lives, and in our Lord's running of his church, there is always this pronounced element of mystery. So that's the first thing in our passage, a mystery. Secondly, a mixture. A mixture. So a key character then in Acts 25 is, of course, Porcius Festus. What are we to make of him? How should we evaluate this Roman governor? Well, the dominant emphasis in the passage is that Festus is ethically compromised. He's ethically compromised. I mean, it's most explicit in verse 9, where Luke says Festus was wishing to do the Jews a favor. In other words, he's not motivated by purely judicial considerations. He wants to keep certain people happy, and that's affecting then his application of justice to Paul. It's explicit there in that verse, but you detect it, don't you, in some of the comments he makes to Agrippa later on. In verse 18, he says that when Paul's accusers stood up, they brought no charge in his case of such evils as I supposed. In verses 25 and 26, he says, I found that Paul had done nothing deserving death. Verse 26, I have nothing definite to write to Caesar about him, therefore I brought him before you all so that we may have something to write. And all of that, then it prompts the question, well, Festus, if Paul's accusers didn't make a compelling case against Paul, as you're saying there in verse 18, and if you're kind of scraping the barrel for things to write about Paul to Caesar, as you're saying in verses 25 and 26, then why on earth didn't you acquit Paul in the first place? Okay, after Paul had appealed to Caesar, that was no longer an option for Festus. He couldn't then acquit Paul. He then had to refer Paul to Caesar as requested. He was legally obliged to do so. But Festus could have preempted Paul appealing to Caesar in the first place if at the end of verse 8, after he's heard the prosecution and the defense, he had simply acquitted Paul at that point. And Festus's failure to do that then, it was no innocent mistake. It was a deliberate rejection of what he knew to be the just and right course of action. That's why Paul says in verse 10, to the Jews I have done no wrong, as you yourself know very well, Festus. You know the score. You know the situation. So Festus is ethically compromised. That's the dominant emphasis, but it's not the only emphasis. There's a tension, isn't there, between verses 2 to 5 on the one hand and verse 9 on the other. Because in verses 2 to 5 then, Festus is unwilling to let Paul be tried in Jerusalem. The Jews are saying, can we have a trial here of Paul? And Festus says, no, Paul's in Caesarea, I'm going there soon, you'll have to come there. He's quite insistent on that. But then you jump to verse 9, and Festus seems only too willing to send Paul to Jerusalem to be tried by the Jews there. Why this turnaround? Why this tension between those two sections of our passage? Well, I think the answer is that Festus knows very well in verses 2 to 5, or at least he suspects, that the Jews have some plot up their sleeves, that they're going to try and ambush Paul. And if he sends Paul to Jerusalem at that point, Paul will get ambushed on the way. Whereas in verse 9, if he just suddenly sends Paul unexpectedly to Jerusalem, the Jews won't be ready to ambush him, and that won't happen. In other words, although, yes, to some extent then, Festus is biased against Paul, at the same time, he is concerned for Paul's protection. He doesn't want Paul to be ambushed on the way to Jerusalem. And indeed, notice that even though, as we've seen, he, in verse 9, is quite happy now to hand Paul over to the Jews in Jerusalem, even there, he's not going to let them try Paul entirely on their own terms. He says, do you wish to go up to Jerusalem and there be tried on these charges before me? One commentator says the words before me emphasize that Festus would officiate at any future trial and not abandon Paul to the jurisdiction of the Jews. And then notice too that when Paul appeals to Caesar, Festus honors Paul's appeal to Caesar. Brexit means Brexit. We've heard that slogan, haven't we, several times from the government since June. In other words, we must honour the outcome of the referendum even if we don't like it. That's what the government is saying. And Festus then probably doesn't like the fact that Paul here appeals to Caesar. I mean, for one thing, it removes altogether the possibility of Paul going and being tried in Jerusalem, which, as we've just seen, is what Festus really wants to happen now. And for another thing, it will raise question marks actually over Festus's competence. Caesar probably isn't going to take kindly to such a trivial case being referred to him. Why didn't Festus deal with it? Why couldn't it be dealt with at local level? Why does this Roman citizen Paul have such a lack of confidence in Festus that the case has had to be referred to me? That's what Caesar will ask. So it's probably not good news for Festus, yet he honours it. Verse 12, to Caesar you've appealed, to Caesar you shall go. He doesn't try to dissuade Paul. He doesn't try to prevent Paul going to Rome through some kind of skullduggery. No, he honours the appeal to Caesar. And so I'm saying then that there are these two emphases in our passage. Certainly, Festus is ethically compromised. That's what's most conspicuous here. That's the bottom line. There's this crookedness, this twistedness about the man. But for all that, there are flashes of virtue and integrity. There's some good tempering the bad. There's this moral mixture in Festus. It's there, albeit less obviously, in Agrippa too. You know, the way that Agrippa suddenly turns up at Caesarea with this woman Bernice. Perhaps you've read that many times and always assumed that Bernice is Agrippa's wife. Bernice is not Agrippa's wife. What is she? Is she his mistress? No, she's not his mistress. Bernice is Agrippa's sister. You might say, what's the big deal about that? There's nothing wrong with a chap travelling around with his sister. Well, no, there isn't, except that other first century records outside the New Testament give us reason to believe that this was an incestuous relationship between Agrippa and Bernice. So he too then has a real unsavouriness about him. And yet fascinatingly, we find him saying of Paul, don't we, there in verse 22, I would like to hear the man myself. It's fascinating. I mean, he knows what Paul stands for. Paul will say that, won't he, later in chapter 26, verse 26. The king, that's Agrippa, knows about these things. That's about the gospel that I've just been preaching, effectively. I'm persuaded that none of these things has escaped his notice, for this has not been done in a corner. Agrippa is part of the Herod dynasty. He knows about the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and he knows that if he has an audience with Paul, he's going to get an earful of that. He's not going to get from Paul some jolly stand-up comedy routine. He's not going to get from Paul some elegant poetry recital. He knows that if he listens to Paul, what he's going to get from Paul is an earful of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And yet, fascinatingly, he volunteers for that. And he's not doing it as a favour to Festus. It's only afterwards that Festus says, oh, well, you can help me here, Agrippa, because you can help me come up with some charges that we can send to Caesar about this man. But it's before that that Agrippa is volunteering to hear the Apostle Paul. There's an openness toward and a respect for the Christian gospel in this man. And again then, amidst pronounced moral waywardness, there are glimmers in Agrippa of better things. There's this mixture. And it's a phenomenon we constantly encounter, isn't it? It might be the boss at work, and he's cheated on his wife, and he's walked out on his family, and he's gone off with another woman. And a couple of years later, he does exactly the same thing all over again. In his private life, this man is a shameful liar who leaves behind him a trail of hurting innocent victims. And yet, when you've been in a difficult situation at work, you found him very fair in his dealings with you. And he's always kept his word to you. And he's been patient with your mistakes. There's a mixture in this man. It might be a neighbor in your street, and she spends most of every weekend in an intoxicated state, and she often plays loud music with offensive lyrics in it. She has this wild, morally unrestrained lifestyle, and yet, when your bin has blown over and emptied its contents on the street, or your car is stuck on your snow-covered drive, she's the neighbor who unsolicited comes to your assistance. Again, this mixture. And the Bible then, it gives us the theology, doesn't it, that explains this phenomenon. Certainly, the Bible tells us that since that fateful moment in the Garden of Eden, every human being has inherited at conception a moral depravity. And that moral depravity, it's not peripheral and episodic and controllable. On the contrary, it's controlling. It's the dominant factor in every man or woman's life, affecting every aspect of a person's being. Paul puts it most vividly in Romans 6, where he says that human beings are slaves of sin. The Bible certainly tells us that. But it also tells us that God is graciously disposed toward this sin-enslaved human race. The most exquisite outworking of that gracious disposition is his complete renewal of millions of human beings by the operations of his Son on the cross and the operations of his Spirit in the hearts, freeing them from sin slavery. But that gracious disposition he has toward the human race, it also has a more basic outworking. In the millions of other human beings who are never freed from sin's slavery, God nonetheless prompts moments of virtue and integrity. Moments of virtue and integrity that are anomalous, really. They don't fit with the tyranny of sin in that person's life. They just, as it were, come from nowhere. They don't fit with the general pattern. They're just the promptings of a gracious God refusing to allow his creatures to become the moral monsters that they would otherwise become. And that accounts then for twisted Festus's better moments in our narrative. That accounts for the way the unsavory Agrippa suddenly surprises us, in a good sense, there in verse 22. It accounts for the unexpected instances of decency in that screwed up boss or that screwed up neighbor. And this reality then, that God interferes with the tyranny of sin in unbelievers' lives and punctuates the behavior of the unbeliever with uncharacteristically commendable deeds, it should produce at least two responses in us. Number one, we should be thankful. Deeply thankful. What a hellish place this world would be if God didn't do that. If sin's tyranny in the lives of unbelievers was entirely uninterrupted and unmodified. if your colleagues and family members were untouched by the restraining, civilizing, humanizing grace of God, what a place this world would be. And yes, of course, we pray for the sin-liberating grace of God to touch our colleagues and family members. But nonetheless, we're thankful that they are at least touched by this more basic outworking of God's grace. It's part of what makes this curse-ravaged world bearable, isn't it? As we wait for the return of Jesus Christ and the ushering in of that better world to come. It should make us thankful, but it should also make us careful. It should make us careful. In our view of unbelieving men and women, we must give due emphasis to this truth, that in all of them there is good tempering the bad. I know, of course, we must give due emphasis to that more fundamental truth, that all of them do have this controlling depravity, so that however decent and respectable they may appear, like Nicodemus, without being born again, they will not see the kingdom of God. We must give due emphasis to that. But I think in our Reformed evangelical circles, we probably do give due emphasis to that. But perhaps we don't give due emphasis always to this other truth. And I think we need to be careful, especially as our society moves further and further away from its Christian past, that we don't kind of demonize unbelieving people. We don't slip into a deep-seated cynicism where we start to think that non-Christian politicians are never motivated by a desire to make the world a better place. And non-Christian doctors are never motivated by a concern for their patients. And non-Christian Ofsted inspectors are never motivated by the potential of education to elevate the lives of children. That cynicism is wrong. It's misplaced. Its instincts are correct. The natural tendency of human depravity is toward base, self-seeking motives. Of course it is. But it overlooks this factor, the grace of God, which in non-Christian politicians, non-Christian doctors, non-Christian inspectors, non-Christian whatevers, will create this moral mixture that we've identified in Festus and in Agrippa. There will be good tempering the bad, and we must never, therefore, slip into that demonizing cynicism that I'm talking about. So we have in our passage a mystery, a mixture, but thirdly and very briefly, a mastery. A mastery. We encounter in this chapter Festus. We encounter in this chapter Agrippa. We don't, of course, encounter in this chapter Caesar. We don't meet him here. In fact, we don't meet him at all in the book of Acts. It's one of the things that puzzles writers on this book quite considerably, that Paul ends up in Rome, but we never, even then, encounter Caesar. But while we don't meet Caesar then, in Acts 25, it's fair to say he does cast his shadow over this chapter, and it's an impressive shadow that he casts over it. So the town where Paul is in custody, it's Caesar's town. It's named after him, Caesarea. The tribunal that Paul is appearing before, yes, Festus is presiding over it in the immediate sense, but it's really Caesar's tribunal. That's what Paul says in verse 10. I am standing before Caesar's tribunal. By the way, he's not there appealing to go to Rome. That doesn't come until verse 11. He's simply saying in verse 10 that I am now, at this moment, in Caesar's tribunal. This tribunal, this court here, belongs to Caesar. The town is his. The tribunal is his. Even the Roman governor himself is Caesar's That's what Festus says, isn't it, in verse 26. I have nothing definite to write to my Lord about him. Who's his Lord? Caesar. He's claiming that Caesar kind of owns and rules him. So I'm saying then that Caesar has this mastery over the town Paul is in, the tribunal that Paul is appearing before, the very governor who presides over that tribunal, and it's all very impressive stuff indeed. But there's one little touch in this chapter that we shouldn't overlook. When I'm at my running club at Gosforth Harriers, I always feel a little bit inadequate. There are all these guys who kind of run 30, 40, 50 more miles a week, and my weekly mileage is rather pitiful compared to all of that. But there's one occasion in the year when I'm in a setting where I feel like a proper athlete and I can feel really good about myself. It's when I'm at the Banner of Truth Ministers Conference, and there over the mealtime in the evening, people will talk about the sessions, the talks, and then the question might come up also, what have you been doing in your free time today? And one guy will be very pleased with himself because he's managed to walk 1.5 laps of the botanical gardens, and someone else has perhaps done a slow jog around the university campus, and then they'll say, well, Dan, what have you done? And I'll say, well, I ran 10 miles, and suddenly you can see horror coming over their faces. And it's a little bit like that here in our chapter. Because notice how in one verse, in verse 19, Luke drops in another character who hasn't been mentioned hitherto in the chapter. It's Jesus. And notice that Luke drops in his mastery. And his mastery then isn't over a town. It isn't over a tribunal. It isn't over a governor. It isn't even over a great earthly empire. All of that suddenly seems a bit pathetic, actually, a bit pitiful, a bit inadequate compared to this mastery. Jesus' mastery extends over death. He was dead, but is alive. I mean, that's something that Caesar couldn't claim. He could claim some mastery, but not this mastery. Indeed, isn't that part of the significance of the title Caesar? That it kind of gives this impression that the Caesar lives forever. Of course, he doesn't. We never get his first name here. This is Caesar Nero. They didn't go by their actual personal names, just Caesar, because that then gave the impression that the Caesar lives forever. But it was just an illusion, because, of course, no Caesar lived forever. No Caesar had mastery over death. But Jesus has mastery over death. And what a tremendous thing that is for the believer. Don't we see Paul basking somewhat in the confidence of that when he says in verse 11, that I don't seek to escape death. That's pretty much what every human being that you meet is doing, isn't it? Trying to escape death. That's the great human pursuit. Whether it's through medicine, plastic surgery, whatever, trying to escape death. That's what people are constantly trying to do, trying at least to put it off. Paul says, no, not me. Why? Because he knows the one who has mastery over death. And it's just with that thought that I want us to close this morning. Do you know the one who has mastery over death? Don't try to escape death, deter death, somehow get round death, modify death in silly, superficial ways. Come this morning to the one who has been into death and has burst it open. The one we read of in our opening verse at the start of our service. I have the keys of death and Hades. He got himself out of death. He will get every one of his followers out of death safely and onto resurrection terrain, the other side of it. Come to this master who makes Caesar look so puny, who makes Barack Obama look puny, who makes every earthly ruler look puny, because his mastery stretches even over that impenetrable, murky realm of death. Come to Jesus Christ, the true Lord and Emperor. Amen.